This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a new report on how the housing crisis in America affects people who pay rent, another energetic socialist campaign in the state of Washington, and reminiscences from Bob Moses on the Freedom Summer of 1964.
But first, thousands of households have had their water shut off in Detroit. Under orders of the city's state-appointed emergency financial dictator, Kevin Orr. Orr is anxious to turn Detroit's water facilities over to private business and has retained a private contractor to cut off the water to residents who are behind in their bills. At the current pace, the cutoffs could soon affect 30,000 households. A panel of experts at the United Nations has declared that the Detroit water shutoffs constitute an affront to human rights. We spoke with Abiyomi Azikiwe, an organizer for the Moratorium Now Coalition and editor of the Pan-African Newswire.
The water shutoffs violate even the policies of the Detroit Water and Sewage Department. If you have an arrears in regard to your bill, you can make arrangements to pay the bill by making a down payment of sometimes 40 to 50%, and the remaining balance can be paid in installments per month. People had arrangements, and they still had their water shut off by this private firm. So this is an effort on the part of the emergency manager to intimidate people, to drive even more people out of the city. But moreover, it's aimed at privatizing and breaking up the Detroit Water and Sewage Department. Detroit Water and Sewage Department is one of the largest and most advanced public water systems in the United States. And they are looking to break up the system, and the breakup is already underway, and also to privatize, either sell it to private interests or have a private company manage the Detroit Water and Sewage Department. So they really have an agenda, and the shutoffs, supposedly for bills in excess of $150, is just a pretext to move towards a breakup and privatization of the water system.
So what they're trying to do is shed the system of poor people to make it a more attractive buy.
Yes, and also we have to understand that in 2012, the Detroit Water and Sewage Department was ensnarled in the same type of interest rate swaps that other entities within the city have been plagued by. It took $500 million to terminate these interest rate swaps in 2012. These monies were supposed to be utilized for the purpose of infrastructural improvements and development within the DWSD. That's why now we have huge water main breaks and then other problems associated with the water system. So rather than hold J.P. Morgan Chase, which in fact was responsible for these interest rate swaps to the tune of $560 million. Rather than going after them and demanding that they claw back the funds that were stolen from the public, they allowed them to rip this money out of the system. And that explains why the system is plagued with debt. It has nothing to do with the fact that people are behind in their water bills. Some of the most egregious delinquent water bills are with some of the most lucrative capitalists here in the city. For example, the Illich family. There are reports that indicate that they owe tens of thousands of dollars in arrears in their water bill. And other entities owe money, and they have not been shut off. So this is specifically targeted at working people and poor people in order to drive them out of the city and at the same time lay the basis of the privatization of the Detroit Water and Sewage Department. And this is taking place right under the nose of Judge Rhodes in the bankruptcy court, and there should be efforts taken. And there's some research being done on this now and filing some type of court action to try to stop the shutoffs and also to try to shed light on these privatization efforts by the emergency manager.
The United Nations report predicts that as many as 30,000 households could be cut off from water in the next few months. 30,000 households would amount to a lot more than 100,000 people.
Oh, yes. You know, it's good that the complaint was filed with the United Nations, and they have issued a statement, but it's not going to result in people's water being turned back on, and it hasn't resulted in a moratorium on the shutoffs, which means that we have to build a broader struggle here in the city of Detroit to bring that about. Now, the Moratorium Now Coalition has been organizing demonstrations every week. We call them Freedom Friday. And for the last 4 weeks, we have been demonstrating at the Detroit Water and Sewage Department to draw the link between the economic crisis, the appointment of an emergency manager, the illegal forced bankruptcy, and the termination of thousands upon thousands of households' water services. We have to, in fact, build a movement against this. If you look at the whole situation involving bankruptcy, these issues should be brought before the bankruptcy court. How can you make moves to privatize a public institution and the court, the federal court in bankruptcy, is saying absolutely nothing about it? So we're in the process right now of developing some type of court action to demand that the shutoffs be halted and that the people who have had their water shut off, that they be restored, because the services have been shut off for families with children, which places the children at risk of being kidnapped by the Child Protective Services and held. They also endanger people's lives in terms of not having water. Elderly people, people with disabilities, people who have illnesses, all of these sectors of the population are being imperiled by what Kevin Orr, the emergency manager under the direction of Governor Snyder, is doing.
It seems like what Kevin Orr is creating is a very hostile environment in Detroit for poor people. Is this part of a move to get poor folks out of town?
Well, yes. If you look at the last census report for the city of Detroit between 2000 and 2010, the city of Detroit lost 237,000 people. That's approximately 25% or one quarter of the overall population. Now, these people didn't leave voluntarily. They didn't want to leave. Many of them were forced out as a result of predatory lending in the mortgage industry and also the theft and outsourcing of jobs. These are the major problems that exist in the city of Detroit. And if you look at the plan of adjustment, which is now before the federal bankruptcy judge Rhodes, there's nothing in that 600-plus page report that talks about the necessity of creating jobs, about the necessity of imposing a moratorium on foreclosures and evictions, nothing about the necessity of repairing and making whole the households who have fell victim to the predatory actions of the banks. The banks have been involved in predatory lending, both in the mortgage industry as well as in municipal finance. And this is why the Moratorium Now Coalition has called openly for the cancellation of the debt, because that is what is at the root of the economic crisis in Detroit. It has nothing to do with the corruption of the former mayor, and this is often brought up in media reports around the country and indeed around the world. He was in no position to steal even one-hundredth of 1% of what the corporations and the banks have stolen. The people who purportedly gave him money were not indicted, and they were not jailed. In fact, the leading capitalist corporations even gave the former mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick, money to leave town to get a house in Texas and set him up in another job. So none of these corporations and wealthy individuals were held accountable for the crimes. It was only Mayor Kilpatrick and Bobby Ferguson and some of their underlings who were held in criminal contempt and convicted and sentenced and imprisoned for these alleged illegal activities. But the real criminals, the J.P. Morgan Chases, the Bank of Americas, the UBSs, the Merrill Lynches, all of these people have gone unscathed, and they're the ones that need to be held accountable. Just over the last several years, the banks have been fined and have been required to pay the federal government billions upon billions of dollars. But none of this money has been redirected towards reconstructing the cities like Detroit in terms of creating employment, putting people back in their homes, keeping people in their homes, providing services, public transportation, and so forth. And this whole bankruptcy is really designed to destroy the people of the city of Detroit even further, to bust the unions, and to privatize the public assets. They're attempting to privatize the Detroit Institute of Arts, the Detroit Public Lighting System. Belle Isle illegally has been placed under a 30-year lease on the part of the state. Now they're trying to privatize the Detroit Water and Sewage Department, the garbage collection, and other issues. They, too, have already been privatized. So this is the real agenda of the emergency manager, the governor, and the people they work for within the financial and corporate community.
Even the federal bankruptcy judge has given lip service to the idea that the welfare of the community should have weight in these bankruptcy proceedings.
Well, he has given lip service, but little else. We're able to get over $200 million clawed back from the interest rate swap of 2005 that was engineered by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, and UBS. But he eventually approved a deal to still turn over $85 million to these criminal banking institutions. We owe them nothing. In fact, they owe us. We've already paid them $300 million for these interest rate swaps. In a ruling in January, the judge had said that Jones Day Corporation could and had a legal basis for going after Bank of America and UBS, but then he reversed himself in a subsequent ruling. So obviously he's under pressure, and obviously this whole situation is being orchestrated from Wall Street and from the White House to further ensnare and to underdevelop the city of Detroit and its people.
With water cutoffs affecting possibly 100,000 or more people, we should have a base for mass action in Detroit in resistance.
Yes, we're working on that. And in fact, this vote on the plan of adjustment is underway right now. And it needs to be stopped, period. It's a rigged vote. They have sent out ballots to the retirees and city workers and other so-called creditors. But the votes are not being counted here in the city of Detroit. The whole process is being coordinated by a private company in California, and there's no monitoring. And in fact, they sent out another letter just this week telling people that if they voted no, they could still send them another ballot so they could vote again. So this is clearly a setup. It's a rigged election. Also, we are seriously considering taking action in an attempt to stop the vote because it's just too egregious. The fact that there's no one monitoring the entire process of counting the votes, they set up the process, and now there's no one monitoring the vote in terms of the interests of the people. Now, in terms of a mass resistance, the people of Michigan voted against emergency management in 2012. We have consistent demonstrations outside the federal bankruptcy court. We're doing Freedom Friday every week. Over 600 people have filed legal objections to the plan of adjustment. This has necessitated the judge to set hearings. So on July the 14th, there's going to be a hearing on all of the people who filed objections. There were some 100 people who were selected out of the 600 who filed legal objections to the plan of adjustment. They're going to have their day in court. Each one is going to get 5 minutes to go before the federal court to explain why they feel that this whole process should be reversed. So we're going to be mobilizing for that as well. We're going to have not only people in court, but we're going to have people outside of court. So once they go in and testify, they'll be able to come out and also speak to the media and to the people outside who are opposed to what's going on. Also, the additional 500 people will also hopefully be in attendance, and they, too, will have an opportunity to speak out against these activities. But this is being challenged. The only problem is that the White House and Wall Street are working in collusion to carry out this operation. And Detroit is being used as a springboard to implement these policies throughout the United States. That is the theft of public pensions, the expropriation of public assets. And in essence, what they want to do is create an entire privatized system within all of these municipalities so they can be in a position to exploit the residents of the municipalities at an even greater level.
That was Abiyomi Ezekwe of the Moratorium Now Coalition in Detroit.
The U.S. housing crisis remains acute, especially for the urban majority who rent their homes. A new report is out titled Renter Nation: Solutions to the Housing Affordability Crisis. Its authors at the Right to the City Alliance say the crisis of affordable housing over the next generation will be concentrated among renters, with low-income people of color at the center. Rachel LaForest is executive director of the Alliance. She says government housing policy has always favored homeowners and disadvantaged renters. Does this make any sense?
And that's exactly the sort of rhetorical question that we're trying to address in the report, that renters are already the majority in this country. They have been for decades. But if you look at the subsidies that come from the federal or the state or the local level and are supported by policies at the federal, state, and local level, they overwhelmingly go to support the acquiring of private property, being an individual homeowner. And we're not trying to demonize homeownership, but we also want to pull away from this culture of demonizing a renter. You know, when we were writing the report and we wrote that people of color are disproportionately renters, the connotation of disproportionate almost feels negative, you know, as if these people are in a negative situation. We don't think that renting is a problem. Collective ownership of property is a wonderful thing. The problem is, in this country, you typically rent from an owner who is the single proprietor or the single owner of a parcel of land or a building or a multifamily dwelling, and it's difficult to get accountability around that. One of the issues that it's very hard to get accountability around is the issue of affordability. And the fact that because housing and land are commodified in this country and that there is a culture of singular ownership and commodification, that's where you really have some of the cornerstone struggles around affordability, because people are trying to turn a profit as opposed to providing a decent, stable, affordable place for human beings to raise their families and love each other.
Yes, and many Black folks subscribe to the home ownership as the measurement of progress theory.
Part of what that speaks to is the fact that one of the primary ways for communities of color to be able to build wealth, or even families of color to be able to build and accumulate wealth in this country, has been through home ownership. So you pay your mortgage and you develop equity in this piece of property that, if the market says it's worth something, you will be able to get some wealth that you can use and borrow off of to send your kids to college or to buy a new car, to do lots of things. And we feel that it's problematic that home ownership hasn't been one of the very few ways that communities of color have been able to build wealth. The report outlines other models of cooperative housing that, in fact, do allow for people to build wealth and also maintain an investment in the communities that they live in, and maintain the housing that they live in as affordable housing to people who may come after them. You know, it's not about turning a profit at every corner, but actually maintaining the health and viability of the neighborhood for anyone who may be moving into your housing after you.
So homes should be places to live in and build communities in, not necessarily places of investment.
That's exactly right. And I was talking earlier today with someone about a tax. You know, there's an idea about a tax being levied on when a mortgage changes hands or is traded, you know, and this really is with regard to Wall Street or the people who actually hold the loans. But there's a lot of flipping and trading of these mortgages from one financial institution to the next. And there should be a penalty if that's going to happen, so that it actually discourages folks from shifting those properties or those loans around in the effort to make more money.
Yes, that brings us to the question, what forces are behind making private home ownership the model in the United States?
You know, one of the toughest pieces of it is hearts and minds. This has been something that has been a cornerstone of American culture for centuries. The right to own and have self-determination on your own land. I think it's been twisted in that at the time that this country was founded, it was people who were running from the rule of Europe then really wanting to make place for themselves and saw their sovereignty come through the rights to be able to do this. But in a capitalist society, what that turns into is creating a very large gap between the haves and the have-nots. And in a racist society where people of color are actually pushed out of institutions and marginalized away from processes that help them build power or have access to these mechanisms in an equal and fair way, then you're just stacking the cards against them. It becomes something that caters to the 1% or the top 15%, and then the vast majority of the rest of us are left scrambling to figure out how to put food on the table for our kids, get them clothes to be able to go to school, and then make the rent on time.
People usually refer to the crisis for homeowners, but you say in the report that renters are facing a perfect storm of rising rents and falling income.
That's right. There's a lot of fantastic wage battles going on throughout the country. There are a lot of fights for increases in minimum wage. There have been excellent, really good campaigns around getting a living wage, not just a minimum wage, but a wage that actually allows people to live healthy, dignified lives. I think renters have been in the middle of this affordability crisis for decades. And the reason why we're characterizing this as a perfect storm is that what we're seeing happen in the wake of the foreclosure crisis is Wall Street is coming to take a second bite at the housing securities apple. And so we've got private hedge funds who are being funded by the very same banks who caused the crash in the first place. Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, Deutsche Bank are financing these hedge funds to go into communities that suffered from the housing crisis, many of them low-income communities of color, and buy up, I mean, really essentially pick the market clean, being able to pay cash for these foreclosed homes, and they're now converting them into rentals. And guess what? The new rentals are not just not affordable. In many instances, in a number of cities around the country, they're charging above the standard market rate rent for people to move in. So it's exacerbating gentrification, it's exacerbating the affordability crisis, and it is creating what we characterize as this perfect storm. And we feel that there's got to be some intervention. It needs to come at the federal level, it needs to come at the state level, at the city level. There needs to be some regulation because besides the day-to-day crisis that they're causing, we think that this could be the second coming of another housing bubble.
But as you said, if there is intervention, it would have to be against those same banks, the same hedge funds also, that caused the crisis of 2008.
That's exactly right. And, you know, there's been little to no accountability of those institutions to begin with. I mean, there have been a number of really good settlements that were moved by some organizations in this country to have the banks pay up. I would like to call it reparations of sorts, but we're talking 10, 15, you know, $14 billion, which feels like a lot to you and me, but is a drop in the bucket for these financial institutions. And when you tally up the devastation that they've caused, how much money individual families and cities and states have lost, having to deal with blight, having to deal with people needing to relocate and the loss of their wealth, $14 billion doesn't make up for what was lost.
And these new predatory rental outfits that are buying up all of these rental properties, such as the Blackstone Group, are now marketing rental securities.
That's right. So this was a huge flag for us. In November of last year, Blackstone Group was able to secure the first AAA rating on a securitized rental. So here we are again, where because Wall Street is essentially a big casino where the players are able to gamble on their products, there's no concern at all for the quality of the product at all. It's just about being able to pass the hot potato around, have it shift hands as much as possible, and reap as much profits from that shifting around as they can. So the real danger is in allowing Wall Street to come back in and do with rental properties what they did on the mortgage market. For me, I just say, have we not learned, have lawmakers not learned the lesson of what happened in 2008? What's promising is that there seems to be a concern across the aisle around this issue in particular, because I think there's plenty of conservatives and Republicans, poor babies, who lost money after the crisis as well. You know, people can't go out and consume things, and so whatever products they're peddling don't get sold either. So we're hopeful that there's a lot of good attention being paid to this securitization of rental properties, because that is, in fact, what will allow for a second housing bubble to be created.
And what are some of the solutions that you suggest to make housing more affordable?
One big one is resourcing the National Housing Trust Fund. This is a fund that ironically was created under George Bush that recoups money from dividends that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the largest mortgage holders in the country, make each year and funnels it into this fund where the money gets parceled out to states specifically and exclusively for the creation of affordable housing. And we're not talking about a few thousand dollars. We're talking about millions of dollars that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac make in dividends every single year that could fund this National Housing Trust Fund in order for there to be more affordable housing created. In addition to that, the report explores both reform-type solutions that assume that the market will continue to run in the way that it does, but it also posit some transformative solutions that imagines a different kind of housing market, one that actually holds housing as a human right as opposed to a commodity to be traded and made profit off of. And so some of what we're putting forward is there are collaborative models of housing like community land trusts, like limited equity cooperatives, and even some hybrid models that are being explored by some academics and activists and organizations that, as I mentioned earlier, allow for families to accumulate wealth but really maintain the permanent affordability of the housing. We hear all the time that there's a fiscal problem. Where will the money come from to be able to finance this affordable housing? And all I have to do is, I'm from New York, I think about, well, how many millions of dollars does it take to run a homeless shelter every year? And if you took that money and actually created permanently affordable housing and allowed people subsidies to be able to live in that housing, they'd be able to get back on their feet and go and get a job and actually have a place to put their kids to bed at night. So the money is out there. It's just a matter of what it gets prioritized for. I mean, we're deep in this conversation about war with Iraq again. It's insane to me that we could even be thinking of putting millions, if not trillions, more dollars in taxpayer money toward external wars and inflating and holding up the lives of the 1% as opposed to investing in affordable housing for everyone.
And even without talking about transformative ideal solutions, you discuss the creation and implementation of a real renter's bill of rights, mm-hmm. one that could go into effect even without transformative housing creation projects.
That's right. And a number of our member organizations are already winning victories at the local level, at the city level, getting perhaps not a comprehensive renter's bill of rights that touches on every single point we outline in the report, but components of it. So just cause eviction and ensuring that landlords are not allowed to throw tenants out, you know, with all of their belongings and their families out just at a whim because they realize they can make an added buck if they do a quick flip of the place and lure in a tenant that can pay more money. Basic repairs, ensuring that when a family goes into hardship, they actually have a way to be able to stave off some of the rent and negotiate a deal with their landlord so that they can get back on their feet again and be able to pay rent. Solid and consistent affordability mechanisms. So what's difficult is that the way that affordability gets calculated now is the cities or states use something called an area median income. And that takes into consideration a huge swath of geography. Take New York, for example. I live in Queens. If someone wanted to calculate the area median income for my area, they would include all of Long Island, pieces of Westchester, communities where very, very wealthy people with multi-million dollar homes live in order to calculate what I could afford on my salary. We think that that's wrong, that it's not practical. And what government should be using instead is a neighborhood in median income, something that actually looks at the demographics of a neighborhood and calculates affordability based on who lives in a particular neighborhood. Where things get complicated is in heavily gentrified areas where people with lots of money have been able to move into the neighborhood because developers saw that there's an opportunity here to be able to have businesses and restaurants and shopping come into the area. The way that people are able to remain is that there's usually deals negotiated with the developers for them to create a certain number of market rate
apartments, and then another number of quote-unquote affordable apartments. That's where we think, where neighborhood median income is applied to places where there's already been gentrification, is where it gets complicated, because there are already people who are perhaps millionaires. I mean, there are millionaires living in Harlem who would be calculated into that equation. And so there is where there needs to be some creativity, where the people for that particular neighborhood need to think about what is the best and fairest way to calculate affordability that still lets someone who's making perhaps below the poverty line be able to stay in their historic urban neighborhood.
And where does Section 8 housing fit into all this? There seems to be an ever-shrinking supply of it.
Yeah. In large part because the local and state and federal governments don't want to continue to put resources into providing those subsidies. And more you find landlords who are not willing to accept Section 8 recipients, anyone with those subsidies. It's like going to shop in a supermarket that doesn't accept food stamps. The underpinnings of all of this is that there is a interconnected tie between housing and income, and that if people are not paid a living wage, one that actually allows them to live in the community of their choice and be able to shop and afford their housing and send their kids to school, that this will continue to be a cyclical issue that goes on over and over again. So subsidies are only a Band-Aid on a much larger problem, but they need to be fought in tandem with one another. You know, the conversations need to be moved at the same time. There are a lot of reforms that we could have made to housing that, unless income inequality is addressed, it will only stop some of the bleeding. It won't heal up the wound.
Housing has long been the kind of weak plank in the progressive armor, and especially in Black organizations' armor. Do you think your report may firm this up, may put housing more firmly in the progressive agenda?
Yeah, we feel really hopeful that that will in fact be the case. We and our member organizations see housing as a bedrock issue. I remember growing up, my mother was a tenant organizer, and in our home, there were lots of other issues that got discussed. I remember not buying grapes and not buying tomatoes, and, you know, we were standing in solidarity with people who didn't live in the U.S., and there were issues of sexism and racism and all kinds of things discussed in my home, but my mother stayed very rooted to tenant organizing, and I remember asking her why, and her telling me that housing was a bedrock issue, and that if you had a place to lay your head and put your kids to sleep, if you had a place to be able to feed your family and love and grow, that anything else was possible. And so we believe that this report will help to paint a picture for the progressive community that housing needs to be an issue that gets connected with many of the other fights, housing and immigration, housing and women's rights, housing and the wage fight, because our armies, our organizations of progressive and radical folks will be stronger and able to actually fight for other things if, in fact, they don't have to worry about a roof over their head. We just met a researcher who is doing work researching the effects of gentrification on people who are actually able to stay behind. So your neighborhood is gentrifying. You make just enough money to perhaps allow you to stay in one of the quote-unquote affordable units that gets created. And what the research is showing is that for those communities, there's a severely decreased rate in civic participation. They no longer participate in PTAs. They don't vote in school board elections and local elections. There are serious health and psychological implications, not to mention that the disbursement of our communities all over the place because they're being pushed out of their neighborhoods weakens our ability to grow political power. And so if you're forced to work within the American electoral system, the way to actually make changes is to grow your political power and put people in office who actually move according to your agenda. Well, if your neighborhood is diffused all over the country because no one can afford to live in Brooklyn or Harlem anymore, how does that political power grow, or how does it have lasting power? So there's lots of implications that housing has on our ability as a progressive community, or our ability as communities of color or low-income communities or any demographic that you could think of are able to build enough political power and standing to shift things over the long term.
Rachel LaForest of the Right to the City Alliance.
Jess Speer of the Socialist Alternative Party is running for a legislative seat held by Frank Chop, the Democratic Speaker of the House of the State of Washington. Chop is the same opponent that Socialist Alternative leader Kashama Sawant lost to in 2012 before successfully winning a seat on the Seattle City Council last year on a platform to raise the city's minimum wage to $15 an hour. Jess Speer was a manager of that Socialist Alternative campaign. She says now that Sawant has ideologically integrated the Seattle City Council, it's time that a socialist broke the capitalist Republican Democratic monopoly in Washington State Capitol.
Both of those parties are dominating Olympia, and it's completely broken down here. They continue to give massive handouts. You know, that $8.7 billion handout they just recently gave to Boeing was historic. It was the largest handout in U.S. history. And they're both collaborating on criminally underfunding education, not funding our transportation. Instead, they're both serving the interests of big business. The Democrats have controlled Washington State for decades, and we have the most regressive taxation in the entire country. And the Republicans are also in cahoots with the Democrats when it comes to giving these tax handouts. There's something like 500 corporate loopholes that allow companies like Microsoft to pay almost nothing in taxes on their profits, and they starve the state treasury of over $6 billion. And that means we can't fund education and transportation. And what's lacking here in Olympia and in state houses across the country are unambiguous fighters for working people, people that will stand on the side of working people, students, of the elderly, of all people that are disenfranchised, and say, this is what working people need, and we're going to fight for it.
You say that your opponent, the speaker, Frank Chop, oversaw $10 billion in cuts to social services.
That's right. Since the recession, what they ended up doing, because they had the most regressive taxation, most of their revenue comes from sales taxes, and with people being thrown out of work or going to jobs making a lot less money, they have less revenue. Instead of going after the big corporations that have plenty of money stashed away, they instead turned around and cut the budgets for human and health services. They threw people off of basic health programs. 60,000 people were removed from that program. You know, those are people's lives that are in jeopardy. They also were one of the worst in the nation in sticking it to parents and college-bound students and paying for the recession and forcing them to pay increased tuition. The tuition at public universities in Washington went up 61%. At community colleges, it went up 50%. It's one of the highest in the country now.
Kashama Sawant, her plank revolved largely around the demand for a higher minimum wage. You won a $15 an hour minimum wage in Seattle. But in terms of the state minimum wage, you say the speaker can't even get a $12 minimum out of committee.
That's right. And it really exposes him and the rest of the Democratic Party as really just grandstanding and paying lip service to what working people need and deserve. There was a poll that came out earlier this year showing over 60% of people in Washington state, all across, again, the political spectrum, want to see $12. And I think if they had been bolder and had followed, you know, where the wind is blowing, that if they had pushed for a $15 an hour minimum wage and asked people in the polls, you would have also seen massive support for that as well. So rather than even fighting for 12, they're not even allowing it for a vote. They're not allowing it out of committee. What we need are people that are going to fight for that, that are going to lead the way. Just a year ago, nobody thought $15 was going to pass in Seattle. And what we did was take leadership on that issue, go to the picket lines, support the workers, elect an independent representative that was going to really boldly fight for that issue and help build a movement, keep up the pressure on the elected officials. We would do the same at the state level, because it's not just residents in Seattle that need a $15 an hour minimum wage. It's residents across Washington state and across the country. Wages have been stagnated for decades. But yeah, the fact that they couldn't even get it out of committee, I think, again, exposes the role of the Democratic Party and that they just paid lip service to the needs of working people.
Are you finding that the public is more receptive, especially after the battle over the minimum wage in Seattle, to your socialist politics?
Absolutely. I think that now that people in Seattle and across the state and the country have seen what a socialist does once they're elected, that they just don't, you know, go to work and sit in back rooms and make deals with business like the Democrats and the Republicans do, but instead use their elected position to help empower working people, get them actively involved, keeping up the pressure, helping to build, you know, the movements that are necessary. And then again, 6 months later, actually winning one of the core demands of her platform has shown people that socialists are real fighters for working people, that we don't play politics as usual. We're here to bring actual change, and we do that by empowering working people, not just by, you know, merely getting elected, saying a few things as the Democrats and the Republicans do, and then, you know, going and serving the interests of big business. And one of the main reasons we don't do that is, of course, because we're socialists and we understand that the interests of business and the interests of workers are they're opposed to one another, and you can't straddle the fence. You're either on the side of workers or you're on the side of business. I think people in Seattle, in the district that I'm running in, the 43rd district, which is part of Seattle, are very open to a socialist running because Shumma was elected, but also her run in 2012 showed that people really just want an alternative. They may not be clear about what a socialist is, exactly what they would do differently, but they're just tired of the status quo and they want to see an alternative. People are gravitating towards us not only because we provide that alternative, but because of the platform that we're running on. In this campaign, we're running on ending corporate welfare, closing those corporate loopholes, rent control and affordable housing, and also taxing the rich to fully fund education, mass transit, and clean renewable energy so that we can start to transition away from fossil fuels.
Do you think that Frank Chop, who got 70% of the vote against Kashama Sawant back in 2012, you think he's taking your candidacy seriously?
Oh, absolutely. We've heard from people on the inside that he's quite pissed off that we're running again. I think he thought once Shumma got elected last year that he was safe and that he could just go back to business as usual and serve the interests of business without being challenged. But once he heard that we were running, we've heard that some not nice words were said about me and about our organization. And we know how seriously he's taking this campaign because he's told people that he can no longer use the money that's normally donated to his campaign. He usually uses that money to help elect other Democrats. He has told the rest of the Democratic Party, I can't do this. In fact, I need to raise $300,000 to beat this woman. So he knows that we are seriously challenging him, and he's quite vulnerable.
And you, of course, are not going to raise $300,000 from big business. Where are you going to get financing, and how much do you need?
We have the goal of raising between $150,000 and $200,000 so we can match his fundraising. But as you said, we will not be taking any money from corporations or business at all. All the money we are going to be raising is going to come from ordinary working people and workers' organizations. So we invite people, if they support what we're doing, to please make a donation at votesphere.org. Because this race, this campaign is important not only for residents of the 43rd District in Washington State, but the entire country. If we can show for a second time that a socialist can get elected, that an independent can get elected from the left, not from the right, as what happened in Virginia, then that gives hope to people across the country that we might begin the project of building a third independent political party that represents the 99%. That really puts it on the agenda. Shumma got elected last year, and a lot of people are excited about that, but many people are saying it's a flash in the pan, it's a one-off event. Shumma's a very charismatic person. It's all about her. What this campaign will do, if we kick out the Speaker of the House, put all the corporate politicians on notice that we're coming after them, that the people are fed up. But it also shows people that it's not just one person. It's the ideas that are connecting with people. It's the ideas that are exciting people and getting them involved in political activity, for some of them, for the first time.
That was Jess Spears of Socialist Alternative in Olympia, Washington.
Residents of two housing projects in New York's Harlem remain outraged over an early morning raid this month by more than 400 police officers. The cops dragged dozens of young people out of their beds, abusing their mothers, sisters, and brothers in the process, according
according to the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. 103 young people have been charged with attempted murder, weapons possession, and conspiracy to commit such crimes. Project resident Angela Dunmore says the cops are using conspiracy as a dragnet.
They're charging everybody with the crimes of a couple of people, and that is not, it's like you're guilty by association. Because I grew up with this person, or I grew up with this person, and I speak to this person, and I messaged this person on Facebook, and I spoke to this person on Facebook, I'm guilty, and I don't understand that. All of this is a bunch of third-party association, and you're guilty because this is the neighborhood that you're from. Because two or more black people together, it's a gang. Because they feel threatened by two or more black men together, and that is not fair.
Harlem resident Angela Dunmore.
The legendary black liberationist, once known as H. Rap Brown, is seriously ill in a maximum security prison. Mumia Abu-Jamal has this report for Prison Radio.
His name is Jamil Abdullah Alameen, a Muslim imam and a prisoner of the U.S. government. But perhaps he is better known as a fiery young icon of the 1960s era black power movement, H. Rap Brown. He was called Rap because of his quick, snappy style of speech when he gave voice to the most oppressed black communities in America. His outspoken defense of self-defense earned him the eternal enmity of the government, local and federal. And his war against drug dealers in New York resulted in a stretch in New York prisons. In 1976, he was released, a new man, a convert to Islam, and renamed Jamil Abdullah Alameen. He became a founder of the local mosque and a leader of the community. In this new role, he continued to fight against drugs in the community. In 2000, in what many believe was a setup, he was charged with shooting two cops in Atlanta, convicted, and sent to prison. This despite conflicting evidence provided by one of those very cops. One of those shot reported flash information that the shooter was a man 5'10" with gray eyes. Jamil stands 6'5" and has brown eyes. The surviving cop claims to have shot his shooter, and a blood trail seems to support this thesis. There's one problem with that scenario. When Imam Jamil was apprehended days later, he had no gunshot wounds. But ultimately, as stories change, two convictions were returned. Today, Imam Jamil, at 71 years, is seriously ill, the result of a gum infection, which has spread throughout his body, causing weakness, swollen feet and ankles. Poor medical treatment is the norm in American prisons, and Imam Jamil's experience is no exception. For 7 years, he hasn't seen the sun. In his youth, in the 60s, he was at the very forefront of the Black Freedom Movement, serving as a leading figure in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Black Panther Party. He was a stalwart opponent of white supremacy and racism. As an imam, he worked to make Atlanta a better city, free from the scourge of drugs. He deserves better than this.
50 years ago, SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and other frontline civil rights organizations brought 1,000 young volunteers to Mississippi to assist in registering blacks to vote. It was called the Freedom Summer of 1964. Bob Moses, a black school teacher from New York, was field secretary for SNCC. He was interviewed recently by Paul Jay of the Real News Network. Bob Moses said that prior to Freedom Summer, voter registration had not been going well in Mississippi.
You have to go back to the layers of opposition, because Mississippi is, I mean, one of the things that distinguishes the movement in the Mississippi theater of the civil rights movement is that it's acting against the whole state, and there's statewide organized opposition, right, which goes from the highway patrolmen who arrest you to vigilantes who attack you to murder, right? their, Mega is not the only one who's gunned down, right? In the fall of 1963, we actually run Aaron Henry and Ed King. Ed King is a white minister at Tougaloo who is from Vicksburg, Mississippi, for governor and lieutenant governor in a parallel process, and run what we call a freedom vote, right? So people can go and register with us, right, and vote for the candidates.
It's kind of a mock vote to show what would happen if people actually could vote.
If people actually could vote, right. But it's also a consciousness-raising issue, right, to get people in the mindset that one day they are actually going to run candidates and elect people, right? So when we do that, then we get white students come down. Al Lowenstein brings students from Yale and Stanford down. And the National Council of Churches brings 50 ministers from across the Midwest. We have a Freedom Day in Hattiesburg. We have the first integrated picket line. It starts in December and runs right into the summer, right? What allows it to happen is this national attention, right? These ministers coming down from all over the Midwest.
Now, there's a debate going on at this time about direct action versus registration, also direct action versus candidates.
Actually, the issue of direct action versus voter registration had been settled way back. I'm saying way back. I mean, one of the issues is that time is like collapsed. So I think of this period of time is like every year is 5 years, right? So way back in the fall of 1961, the issue of whether we're going to do voter registration or direct action had been settled around the McComb walkout, right? In the summer of 1961, all the action is in a three-county area in the southwest part of Mississippi, right? And it's there. The first time we take people down to register in Amick County, the highway patrol arrests me, right? I have been told if I get arrested, call Collect, call D.C., call John Doe in D.C. And so I did. I said, can I make a call? And I lucked out. Doe was in his office. He accepted the call. That was a seminal moment because what people were now aware of was that we weren't just isolated working here. We had a direct line into Washington, D.C., to the Justice Department, right? So the newspaper the next day tried to call Collect, right? And so it became a big headlines, right? So this was important for black people, right, that they weren't doing this just out there, right, that there was some hookup now to the federal government on this really isolated work going down, taking people down to register, right? So, but then the next time we went down, after that happened, E.W. Steptoe called C.C. Bryant, where I was staying in Macomb, and said, well, can you send some of the SNCC people out into Amit? And so I went out to Amit and began working there. And the next time we went down, I was beaten, right? So this is, you're working your way through the levels of opposition.
Right? There's been some debate whether the Kennedy administration did what it could have. Some of the history tries to suggest that the Kennedy administration was very active in defending and helping the civil rights movement.
Well, here's the thing people need to understand. What actually enabled us to do the work we did was the 1957 Civil Rights Act. Now, there you're dealing with Eisenhower, who was president, and LBJ, who is the Senate Majority Leader from Texas, right? So they get together and pass the first Civil Rights Act since Reconstruction, right? And people say, oh, this is a toothless bill. Actually, Jackie Robinson fires off a telegram to Eisenhower, right, protesting this toothless bill. But that bill didn't anticipate SNCC. So that bill was for, Tuskegee professors who qualified under anybody's standard, right? But it said in there that you can't, interfere with these people when they're trying to register, and you also can't interfere with people who are trying to help them, right? So the Freedom Rides, remember, penetrated the sit-in movement into Mississippi. And the Freedom Riders, when they got out of jail at Parchman, were looking to do direct action, right? And they actually, Marion Barry comes down to Macomb, right, and organizes the young people that we've been working for on voter registration, right, organizes them to do sit-ins. They sit in Brenda Travis, who's a 16-year-old high school student. When she's arrested, they send her off to juvenile detention, right? And so the students, when school opens, decide they're going to walk out and protest this, right? And so we have this big, the first kind of mass demonstration in the Deep South, right? 118 high school students marching out.
What year are we in?
We're in 61, right? After that happens, we're arrested. We're spending our time in jail, about 18 of us in jail, right? And on the 39th day, we get our bail. Otherwise, we're in jail for a couple of years, right? So there's no legal recourse. You don't have people who are able to put up their property for bonds, right, to get people out of jail. So at that point, SNCC, I think, the direct action people in SNCC agree that we're not going to be able to do. They were faced with whether they wanted to do the Nelson Mandela. I mean, if they're going to do direct action, then they've got to do the Mandela. They've got
to go to jail for a long time.
Stay in jail for a long time, right. So that didn't happen.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Martin Nwaga.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.